Okay, and now it gives me great pleasure to introduce our speaker for this evening. Let's welcome Brian C. from Los Alamos.
Thank you. Welcome, everybody. I'm Brian. I'm an alcoholic.
I'm Brian. Hi, Brian.
My sobriety date is 23rd of February, 2017. So I'm almost exactly 2 years, 8 months sober at this point. I'd like to thank Jesse for asking me to speak. I was supposed to do it last month, but you know, I've got quality issues going on in my life now that I'm sober, so that's a good thing. Never too busy to take some time out to do some AA work, though. So this is my first time sharing my story with the group, and I really appreciate the privilege to be able to do this. I've listened to a lot of other speakers by this point. Some very impressive, some kind of not so by the book, I guess. more non-traditional type of speakers. Some things that were suggested to me that I listened to, they said, talk to the newcomer. So I want to make that a point. Because I definitely remember what 30 days was like. I've been there more times over again than I would like to admit, but the important thing is that I kept coming back, and this program works. And the other thing is just to tell my story. So I'm going to do my best to share my experience, strength, and hope with you guys, and what it was like, what happened, what it's like now. My background, I was a 24-year veteran, so I'm used to military briefings, and in training or giving briefings to the commanders, they would always tell us, you know, tell them what you're going to tell them what you just told them. So the reason I liked AA is because it boils things down to simplicity, things I can grab onto when I'm stressed and when I'm overwhelmed and can't. I feel like I can't get a grasp on anything. I can always fall back to the serenity prayer. I can think about those little euphemisms and the things we hear, the placards that are on the walls and stuff in these rooms. And some important lessons that I learned throughout my journey in AA that I'll touch on later, but I wanted to make it a point to point these out right now. Accepting powerlessness and letting go of my self-will. For me, that was paramount because I was trained in the military, well, partly in my childhood, but the military really ingrained that you always have a backup plan, you have control, there's no answer that I don't know the answer to this. Figure it out and make it happen. I've gone through a lot of difficult things in my career, but the one thing that was more powerful than anything I dealt with was alcohol. The other thing was I must be willing to go to any lengths. And then finally, I can't have any reservations. Had to want it for myself, not my family and friends. And those are really important points that I'll touch on later. But yeah, the acceptance and surrender was a huge one for me. So I grew up in Ohio on a farm. I have one younger brother, and he was military too. He was Army and I was Air Force. So I had a little rivalry there. But growing up on a farm was pretty, we spent almost all our time outside. Learned to hunt and fish and everything with my father. my mother was an alcoholic who never made it into this program, never quite made it to the point of admitting that she was an alcoholic. And there's something I may share at the end if there's time, but it's been an interesting year because she just passed away in March of this year from Alzheimer's, which was kind of complicated and accelerated, if you will, by her alcoholism. Growing up, my brother and I, having a mother as an alcoholic, she was very narcissistic and controlling. I remember from the time I was very young, and in first grade I had report cards that said I was too emotional. I was born into this, not realizing it yet, but I was a perfectionist. I had a whole lot of anxiety as a child, and I still do, but now I'm more aware of it. I can tell when that stuff's going on, but at the time that was very traumatic to me as a child. All the other kids, we had to go out to recess, and you know, we had to cut out pictures to make collages and things for school project, you know, art class and all that. Well, we had like magazines and stuff, and the insets have that thin little line that runs around the picture. And I had to cut down that thin line, and not even down the thin line, but either on the outside of the line or just on the inside of the line. And it took me so long to cut out a picture. And I was so focused on it that I totally missed recess all the time. And they called my mom in and said, you know, I would get upset because I couldn't finish a project, and I'd start crying, and that's where the emotional part came in. That stuff got back home, and then my dad, you know, just made it worse because he came home from work and then he would say, why isn't this stuff getting done? And then I would start crying, and I couldn't help. That was who I was. I was an emotional, anxious little kid. So I was taught from very early age. My dad was the type that brought us up that boys don't cry. And if you're going to do anything, you get angry and you take charge of the situation and you fix it. So I was taught anger and taught that crying was bad and showing emotion was bad. This just exacerbated the anxiety, and what I'd realized later on, going throughout my childhood and through my young adult years and up until now, were bouts of what we'd call clinical depression. So growing up with anxiety, depression, and perfectionism just set the stage, and an alcoholic mother, and the fact that there's it's debatable, but there's some relatable genetic traits that, you know, predispose you to alcoholism. This was evident in my mom's side of the family. My safe haven, really my maternal figure growing up, was my grandmother on my mom's side. And my brother and I would go ride our bicycles every weekend. We stayed with my grandmother. It was her farm we grew up on, but she lived in a house about 6 or 7 miles away from the farm. So we would ride there and spend the weekends with her, and I feel like that was really my maternal figure growing up. She was nurturing, kind, and you know, she was more gentle with us and would listen to us. She would share stories with us. She grew up during the Great Depression on a farm just north of there, and So she had lots of stories of her growing up in a big family with 13 brothers and sisters and how life was then, and she shared that kind of stuff with us. So that was the bright spot in my childhood. It was kind of like my safe house. The other safe place for me to be was with my brother outside, away from my mom and dad. Because, as you might expect, the combination of one alcoholic parent and one really angry, he was a veteran as well, had been drafted during Vietnam, and a lot of bottled up issues that he never dealt with. This caused a lot of fighting and arguing between the two of them. I remember some people refer to it as the hero child. Being the older brother, I think I felt responsibility to sort of shield my brother from this a little bit. And I remember also my mom, she smoked, and there was a place in a cupboard underneath where she kept a big bottle of gin. And that was just normal to me. Like, I knew what it was. I never drank as a child or tried it, but I thought all moms just smelled like gin and cigarettes. That was normal to me. And in Ohio, I don't know if people are familiar with this or where you might be from originally, but there were drive-through places where you could buy beer and wine and all the spirits and stuff in Ohio. And I remember going through the drive-thru with my mom, you know, of course, cigarette going all the time. And we just pull in this, like, cool-looking garage thing with neon lights all in it and everything. And he would just put cases of beer in the back and bottles and everything. And I was like, okay, I mean, going through the drive-thru again. Another thing that I didn't, you know, I thought that was normal. Like I said, I was close to my brother, but my dad, for all of his anger issues, was a very nurturing father. He took a lot of time with my brother and I, taught us how to hunt and fish, and took us camping. He was the scoutmaster growing up, and we spent a lot of time with Dad. And he would get he worked at a tubing mill. He was a machinist for his whole life, and he always got, they had shut down the plant in the summertime for a couple weeks, so we would take a week and go camping at one of the lakes nearby. And every time we did something with Dad, Mom was never around. Later on, I realized this was her drinking vacation. And had she been there, she would have totally ruined any fun that we had together. So I think my dad shielded us from her a lot. So you can see how this is all kind of setting the stage for my adult years, things I hadn't realized yet that were going to come to fruition. So the other aspect to my family, there was a whole lot of negativity. I remember after baseball games and stuff, my brother played Little League, and we would usually go to get ice cream at the Dairy Queen or something afterwards. Even something as innocuous as that turned into an argument between my parents. And my brother and I would just, it was so uncomfortable. You know, we just had to be quiet, because if we said anything, then they'd start yelling at us. They're also very judgmental of anything that was different than what we were experiencing, which was obviously normal, you know. So putting down others, very egocentric, hatred, bigotry, racism, you name it, the whole gamut. There was no love or tolerance of others who had any different values or views on life. And like I said, there was a lot of arguing going on. And I go into my teenage years. I was very, very much a square throughout school, all the way through high school. So I didn't grow up in the popular crowds. I didn't hang out to football games, drinking beer out in the parking lot. I didn't do that kind of stuff. I was trying to do whatever I could to try to, I don't know, make the arguing stop, I guess, between my parents. And that was a moving target. What are the expectations? I didn't know, but I was still trying to figure that out. My mom's drinking escalated. As you know, it's a progressive disease. So they continue to get worse. My grandmother at this time was starting to go through Alzheimer's too. That also runs in our family. So my mom was doing a lot of the caretaking of her, which is stressful for a caretaker. So to her, of course, as to any alcoholic, that's just a free pass. Like, well, I'm deserved to have something to relieve the stress. So the alcohol escalated. And it came to a head in high school at one point when I thought my dad was going to take my brother and I and actually leave and go somewhere. I was pretty scared because I didn't know exactly what was going to happen. I didn't have anybody to go to other than, you know, my grandmother at this point was in a care facility at this point. And this is when my dad let the cat out of the bag, one of the family secrets, that my grandfather had committed suicide. And I found this out, you know, when I was in high school. I don't have any conscious memory of him, but I guess he killed himself when I was about 4 years old. There were pictures of me with him. And when the issue ever came up of what happened to Grandpa, it was always, oh, he just had a heart attack or whatever. And that one night, my dad said, why don't you tell him what really happened? Yeah. So that was a pretty big deal. And one of the other things my dad said to me, because of course he said a lot of things out of anger, but my parents were married. They stayed married the whole time. They got married when they were 19 and 20, so very long marriage. But he told my brother and I one time, he said, whatever you do, don't ever get tied down to a woman and get married. He told me that, and I remember it. I had a lot of friction with my mom in high school. Part of that's just being a teenager, and a son of a mother tends to pull away from the mother at that point in their development, because that's just a natural part of growing up. But it was more than that. We fought a lot. And one time my dad pulled me into the garage and he said, if you ever talk to your mother that way again, I'll put you through this wall. And I was scared to death of him. So I was like, okay. And there's the restless, irritable, and discontent. I was involved in extracurricular activities in high school, mainly musicals and stuff. Being on the stage was kind of an escape for me. And this caused a lot of friction because it didn't fit into mom's drinking schedule, of course. I'd need rides from practice and stuff before I had my driver's license. It was always about control and being right, which is another key aspect to an alcoholic mind. I resented. This is where resentment starts. I haven't even started drinking yet. I resented my mom for this and swore to myself I would never, ever be like that. I was like, I'm not going to be an alcoholic. I'm never going to, you know, let alcohol rule my life. I now have since come to accept the fact that this is part of the fabric of who I am. And also, I have to take the responsibility for treating that on a daily basis, and that's where AA comes in. I joined the Air Force when I was 17 years old, and just because I had to escape. 5 years later, even though my dad told me, I ended up getting married to a girl I used to work with when I was in high school. We never dated, but we had always kept in touch when she went away to college. And we wrote letters to each other. I had been in the military 5 years or so, and I went back to Ohio temporarily to work at Wright-Patterson. And I was part of a flying unit there. And she ended up coming to California with me. And we dated for about a year before we got married out here. And she lived with her sister and did some work out on Catalina Island and at some discovery camps and stuff up in the San Jacinto Mountains. 7 years down the road, we ended up having our first son, Alan, after moving to Vandenberg from Edwards. This whole time, first like 10 years or so, I was in the military. Of course, I had been fully ingrained into the military drinking culture. It's pretty much everything of rite of passage to celebrating events, promotions, everything involved alcohol. When I was enlisted air crew, there were a lot of traditions and milestones in that specifically. We were always traveling a lot, deploying to locations all around the globe and with a lot of tropical islands, places really far out of the way, not associated with military bases. So there was a lot of binge drinking going on. It was work hard and party hard. At this point, this is when my drinking first started to progress beyond just fitting in with the crowd type of drinking. I still felt the bouts of depression. I remember about the halfway point through my career, this is right before I moved to Vandenberg the first time, and I was feeling very depressed and irritable, and I just didn't know why. And I kind of knew that I was drinking too much, so I stopped for a while, and I thought, well, I can, you know, obviously I could stop, so that doesn't make me an alcoholic. So I could will myself through this. It's okay. And I was like, a change will be good. I'll get to Vandenberg. We'll have new, just start over fresh again. So we came out to Vandenberg, my first assignment there, and I had an example of one time when I thought I might have drank too much. When I woke up in Tahiti with chickens in my room, and I didn't know why they were there, but there was chickens in my room. I don't know how that happened. I thought, hey, this is probably a sign that maybe I should try to get this thing under control a little bit. So when we moved to Vandenberg, this is right around the time of my first son being born, and I decided to start going to college to get my degree. So I started going to night school, and I was extremely driven and focused because I had something to concentrate on. So I got through school, then I decided to apply for officer training, got selected for that. Went away for several months after the birth of my son, and I became a nuclear missile crew member at that point. Came back to Vandenberg, did more training, and then we moved up to Cheyenne, Wyoming. And as you can see, the level of responsibility and stuff like was tenfold what it had been, and the amount of expectations of perfection were through the roof. That was the standard, was perfection in nuclear operations. And test scores were, if you were below a 98.5% average, the commander was pulling you into his office, you know, on all your testing and everything. 24/7 operations, pulling Nuclear Alert took a lot of time away from the family, and I was gone for that 4-year period. I wasn't there very much. I think I missed every anniversary and birthday and Christmas and Thanksgiving. One Thanksgiving, I actually had them come out to the missile alert facility. They had to drive like 2.5 hours to get out there. And we ate like, you know, canned sweet potatoes and peas and had turkey out there. And during this time too, my second son was born. And also there's a lot of pressure to get master's degree for promotion and assignments and that stuff for officers at that time. So not only was I doing all this, I started going to night school again and spent every weekend and many long nights getting this master's degree completed. The time that I learned to enjoy every bit of time I had off, and I tried to spend as much quality time as I could with my children, and we managed to get some camping trips in and take little vacations. We were close to Colorado, so we explored a lot down there, and I just felt like I was pushed to the very limits of balancing any kind of balance between family and work. There wasn't any. The Air Force pretty much owned me at that point. And I felt like I was turning into an automaton, like a robot, just walked around. I had no human feelings anymore, like an empty husk of a human being, you know? No emotions. I became very callous and harsh. And you tend to take that out on your loved ones. So it was very stressful to my family and for me too. I managed to be present for the birth of both my sons, though. And through all of this time, the drinking was still escalating. Never did I drink on duty, but I was, when I had the chance, I started hiding it from my family. They had no idea how much I was drinking. I kind of felt it was, and I've heard this from other people, I felt that I deserved this because I was providing for my family. And I needed it to kind of reset myself in between these alerts and everything, and the big pushes for inspections were sure never ending. There was always something major going on. What all of this did help me achieve, though, was a board-selected position back to Vandenberg. And we're talking about like the top 1% of the top 10% of maybe 500 crew members. So from each of the missile wings. So out of a couple thousand people, they're choosing like 20 people. And my interview with this the commander that was doing the board selection at this time happened at a local bar, and we drank pretty much all night long. It was close to my house, so I could just stumble home or whatever. But that helped me get that position, and I came back to Vandenberg. And I knew in my heart that I was probably an alcoholic at this time. Probably not wanting to admit it, but I knew I had a problem. And after getting back to California, it took me about a year to start to decompress a little bit. Start to feel like I was getting my life back to somewhat normal again. Had more time to spend with the family. I was part of a group of missile officers here of about 20 or so. And the idea was to groom us to be experts to go out into these very specialized jobs. So as I got acclimated to the job, the temporary duty assignments started coming more and more frequently. So every couple of weeks I was traveling. I was either going to New Mexico, I was going to Omaha, Nebraska, and I was going to Colorado and up to Cheyenne and all over the place. So once again, I wasn't home that much again. And I was in, I was, now keep in mind, I was prior enlisted, and now I'm an officer. So my year group was in an overage because Congress mandated only this many officers per year group. Well, they had tried to cut me so many times, and they couldn't get me. So the Pentagon came up with a new program, and they called it Rapid Improvement Program. So I was, which it didn't improve anything for me. I was in New Mexico at the time, and I got a call that I was had a decision. I had 72 hours to make a decision on whether I was going to go to Afghanistan for a year with the Army or resign my commission, which I had already worked all, the better part of 10 years for, with. I ended up, that was a very hard decision because I lost a really good friend who's Air Force OSI, and his kids, you know, grew up without a dad. So I'm thinking about all this happened when I was in Cheyenne, and I'm almost in that same position, you know. And so I decided to deploy. I ended up going to Afghanistan for a year, being a combat driver there, doing something I totally wasn't trained to do outside the realm of my expertise, for sure. So here's another major resentment I had in my list of resentments I'm building up. I had a resentment against the Air Force because they were out to get me, you know, and I was going to show them. Now, the fact I had deployed over there, of course, we couldn't drink during that year and during the deployment, but I had that reservation for sure. I knew that when I got back, I think it was a self-fulfilling prophecy almost. It's almost like I had to go through this. And I knew it was wrong. But it felt justified. The anxiety at this point, even just prior to the deployment, had gone off the charts, and I was having full-on panic attacks. I couldn't even be in a room with people that I knew. And I had to stand up and give briefings to commanders and all this stuff, and it got to the point where I would just have to leave the room. I just couldn't be in there. I couldn't breathe. I thought I was having a heart attack or something. This is before I deployed to Afghanistan. So then I spent a year in a combat zone, come back, and now I felt like over there that I got addicted to the adrenaline in place of the alcohol. So when I came back, it was a classic case of not adapting very well to normal life. You know, not having people trying to blow you up every day. And I lost all disregard for rules and law, and I started abusing alcohol just so I could survive. It was a survival tool at this point. I felt like a ghost walking around. I felt like my family resented me. I didn't fit in anymore, and I was an outsider. And like I said, I knew that this was wrong, but I knew that alcohol worked to kill the physical and the emotional pain, because I have some, had some issues physically from the deployment as well, and I didn't want to deal with the emotions. The only thing I felt was anger, which underneath all of it was just fear, disguised. Fear of everything. But it worked until it didn't work, like I heard before. I somehow managed to fake my way through my last year and a half of active duty. And I turned in my retirement papers a year out. And that was met with a lot of unhappy commanders. One of which, like, tried to he pulled me in his office, and, you know, he did the old, like, intimidation, fear factor thing, and I put his arm up to block the door and everything. And I was just like, none of this makes sense, you know? At this point, it had progressed, the alcohol had progressed past the point where I had a decision anymore. Initially, I had a decision, or a choice, I should say, of to drink or not to drink. I could have said that was my bottom. I could have asked for help, but at that point, I was trying to still will myself through this. I thought I could overcome this. And I think a lot of that has to do with what my dad instilled in me. So I got to the point of retirement, and by this point, I had built up a bunch of leave, and because I had been gone for so long, I had like 3 months worth of terminal leave. So I was basically not doing anything except drinking. I had sequestered myself at home to sleeping under the olive tree out on my back patio. And my poor kids, they were only like 7 and 9 at the time. And, you know, they were saying, like, Dad, you're like an old dirty hobo. You know? But I was at the point where I knew I needed help. And my wife did step in. She was like, she helped me a lot trying to get into rehabs. Now, I went to no less than 6 30-day inpatient rehabs. And a key point to this is, remember when I first started, I talked about wanting to do it for yourself and not for your family and friends. Can't hold on to your loved ones and expect to try to have them save you. No human power can save us from alcohol. So I was willing. I knew I wanted to get better. So I willingly went to these things, and I would do fine. And the good thing is that's at least 6 months worth of me not drinking, and not continuous, but, and I was introduced to AA in each one of these, right? So I knew about AA. But I had to be willing to go to any length. That part hadn't come yet. My first impressions of AA were, like, I've heard some folks before say, you know, they're like, this is ridiculous. What a miserable existence. I couldn't imagine life without alcohol. I can just get through this thing, satisfy my family, and then I'll clean my act up and everything will just be hunky-dory. Well, having that mindset, those rehabs were not very successful. My final push was a sober living facility in Santa Monica, California. This was the key turning point, though, for as far as AA, because being in sober living, you're allowed to go out in the real world. We got tested and stuff. I didn't have any problems with the not drinking down there. I mean, I really was doing well for the first time. I had several months in a row sober and clean, but I was still thinking, oh, isn't my family going to be so proud of me now? I never got one visit. We had been going, previous to this, we had been going to marriage counseling. And the marriage counselor, while I was down there, called me up and said, hey, you're not allowed to move back into your house. And that was just being that newly sober and not being in it for the right reasons, not wanting it for myself. I was thinking, how dare somebody take the house that I bought and say I can't move into it. And I just about, and it was the worst feeling in the world. I felt like somebody punched me in the gut. And at that point, I made a reservation. I was like, as soon as I get out of here, I'm going to drink. But the good thing about my time down there was it was the first time I had a regular stag meeting. I went to a large men's group every day on Fifth Street above this Italian restaurant. And I loved it because it was the safest place I'd ever felt that I'd ever been. I went through all the steps with my sponsor. And that part was really good. But by the end of it, when I found this out, I couldn't move back into my own place. I ended up getting an apartment, moving back here, because I just couldn't afford it to stay down there anymore. I also couldn't accept the fact that I had also already lost my family's trust. And they're not going to just give me a ticker tape parade and let me back in. So the downward spiral continued from this point. I isolated really, really bad and just started drinking around the clock, 24 hours a day. And ended up getting a DUI in 2016, which for some people, that's a wake-up call. For me, I didn't even care. It didn't even faze me. I just kept drinking more. I had a warrant out for my arrest. Like I said, I had to hit my absolute bottom, which was 23 February 2017. And in a doctor's opinion, it talks about a psychic change. This was the closest thing to the first inkling of that psychic change, or what some might call a spiritual awakening. There's something that came over me at that point, and I remember having the bottle and in my phone, and I had this overwhelming feeling. I was like, if I put this bottle up to my lips, I could feel myself dying. I could feel it. I don't know how to explain it, but instead, I called 911 on myself for the very last time. And I went into the hospital at Marion, and it's the first time I felt like the absolute surrender and absolute powerlessness over alcohol. And I knew that I might not live through this. I was hoping it wasn't too late, but at this point, the doctors and nurses weren't even asking, or they weren't expecting me to make it through the night. And I remember the chaplain being there. And I remember they were trying to get a hold of hospice. They had a social worker there. And my kids had to see me in this condition. So after I made it through the first night, this is the first point where I knew that I wanted to do this thing for myself. I had a decision on whether I wanted to live or die. And up to that point, in those last months, I didn't really care if I died. But now I wanted to try everything and go to any lengths. So I enrolled in, I went through the Veterans Court to resolve all my legal issues, which involved going to more counseling at Coast Valley for substance abuse. I had probation, court every couple weeks. I got through that. What I like to say is that the doctors kept my body alive, but AA has shown me like a framework to live my life again. And I'd like to say mostly happy and joyous, reasonably happy and joyous, because life on life's terms is not. And I've gone through a lot of really difficult things. But I've been able to do it sober and make good decisions. But the most important is the freedom to do that. And unless I'm sober, I don't have that freedom. Now that I kind of see myself on the other side of the mirror, I guess, from where I used to be. And some of the people in this room, a couple individuals in particular, have seen me at my worst. I heard in a meeting the other night, hope, hearing other people's experiences or healing through other people's experiences. I like that. I always learn something new here. It's just my privilege to share this experience, strength, and hope, and that maybe something resonates with some of you out there. And do we have any more time left? Do we have a...
5 minutes past.
I just have one last thing I would like to share with... This is kind of special to me because... I guess I can share it. This is like the closest my mom came to admitting that she was an alcoholic. You know, the last coherent thing she wrote to me, she said, and you'll hear in this like thing about being right or being done with something. She says, "Dear Brian, we are so happy and proud that you have won your battle. Believe me, I know how hard it is to fight. Someday I'll tell you why I had that same problem, but not right now. Right now it's all about you getting your life back in order. My story can wait." That's it. They say that healing is when you can tell your story and not cry, but not quite yet.
One last round of applause for Brian.